This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today, the word association may seem innocuous, but we're going to tell you why its use has caused outrage amongst pro-France loyalists in New Caledonia.
One of the reasons it's anathema to them is that in order to have an associated state, New Caledonia would have to first become independent and then define the associations with France. And for them, any thought of becoming independent, even for a moment or a second or a juridical minute before they then looked at its association, is anathema.
More on that story. And also, PNG may have some of the world's highest rates of maternal mortality, but there is some good news on this issue. We're going to bring you more on why some doctors are suggesting there are lessons that Australia could also be learning from PNG.
We had a good idea of what the real problem was. It wasn't the fact that they were bleeding at all. It was the fact that there's a culture of having babies in a village, and that allows you then to go and work out a solution. And I think some of that is a bit lacking in the way we look after remote areas here.
And more on that story coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, the already troubled mining company Nautilus, that had been hoping to become the world's first deep-sea miner with its Solwara 1 project off Papua New Guinea's coast, is sinking into deeper trouble with an important deadline to secure crucial funding now just days away. It's in dire financial straits, on the verge of bankruptcy. The company says it needs some $350 million US dollars to get started on its controversial mining for copper, gold and silver on the ocean floor, but it's been struggling to secure that finance. The Canadian company's two largest shareholders have stumped up around $17 million US dollars in the interim. Now, it was due to start repaying the loans this week, but it has just been given a reprieve with that deadline extended by 30 days. But Nautilus still only has until Monday to secure an additional $5 million, it says, if it's to continue to operate at all. Now, Pacific Beat has sought additional comment from Nautilus, but we've not received a response. In the statement it provided to the Canadian Stock Exchange, though, it said,
Nautilus must receive the loan or another source of funding on or before January 14, 2019, in order for the Nautilus group of companies to continue operations. There can be no assurances that the company will receive the necessary funding by that date.
Anti-mining campaigners and environmentalists who voice concerns about the effects of deep-sea mining in PNG are watching closely. Among them are the country's former Attorney General, Sir Arnold Armitt.
We are in the campaign, and all of the campaign warriors in PNG are obviously excited that they would go bankrupt.
But he points out there will be implications for the PNG government, which has its own 15% stake in the Solwara 1 project.
The potential, as we were just contemplating when this date was imminent, is the potential liability to the country in our ongoing accumulated body of debts. So it's a double-edged sword for us, whilst if the company inevitably, and that's what we, the campaign people, would like, is to go undersea and become bankrupt, and that will knock out this particular adventure at this point. But of course, they still hold a whole lot of exploration tenements, which is troublesome going forward. This short period of extension for the redemption of this loan that's now due, plus just another week in order to find further finances, really, we would hope, the nail in the coffin for Nautilus here in the Bismarck Sea, Catherine.
So to summarise, really, you think that this perhaps will be a win for the environment, but perhaps not PNG's economy?
Yes. And I think, you know, the price to pay in the long haul for us campaigners and for the protection of our environment and particularly this mischievous adventure, whatever that 15% might be or whatever our take towards that possible liability, at the end of the day, you work out what is the price to pay. And if that's what happens for us, and of course the government agencies and the national government of the day may not be entirely pleased with that, but for many of the maritime provinces of this whole country in the north and south east. That's a welcome sign that this adventure that was mischievous to start with, in our view, should so falter now.
Pacific Beat has sought comment from both PNG's mining minister and Kumul Minerals Holdings, which is the company that manages PNG's interests in mineral operations. Neither have responded so far. Last year, Nautilus suffered another blow when it lost the specialised support vessel, a ship that had planned to use for the Solwater 1 project. The company that it had contracted to build it defaulted on a payment. That saw the contract taken over by another company that plans to use the ship, which had basically been completely built. They're going to use it for its own deep sea mining explorations. But this week, Nautilus has announced that it is trying to reacquire it through a new joint venture company known as the Vessel JV. However, Nautilus has admitted there's great uncertainty on that. In its statement to the Canadian Stock Exchange this week, it said,
"There can be no assurances that the company will be able to successfully negotiate definitive agreements in relation to and complete any of the transactions discussed above."
Sir Arnold Armitt says that with other Pacific nations, such as Nauru and Cook Islands, moving to support seabed mining in their waters, he'd like them to take note of PNG's experience with Nautilus.
This is the classical example of a decision that was, however it was taken and imposed or compelled upon our national leaders at the time, just shows that some of these kind of decisions are better to await, you know, experiments and experiences offshore. This is a classic one of that. There's no example of a model elsewhere of such an investment in the deep sea, and it's happening in all of the South Pacific. This could be a good example that will caution all of our Pacific Island countries to be far more cautious in embarking upon this kind of a venture.
Thoughts of Sir Arnold Armitt, a former Attorney General in PNG, now campaigner against Nautilus operating in PNG. Well, a new report says corals on Australia's Great Barrier Reef that survived two devastating bleaching events are now under attack from coral-eating starfish, which also caused great devastation to reefs in the Pacific. Experts are warning that time is running out, as George Roberts reports.
Underwater images show thousands of the spiny predators wrapping their stomachs around coral and devouring swathes of the Great Barrier Reef. Dr. Udo Engelhardt from Reef Care International is an expert on the crown of thorns starfish.
So I've been looking at this beast for, 30 plus years now.
Dr. Engelhardt's prepared a report for World Wildlife Fund Australia, which stresses the compounding threats of coral bleaching and crown of thorns. Sean Hubin is from WWF Australia.
The key finding for this is that it comes after we've lost half the reef through bleaching events in 2016 and 2017. So the crown of thorns starfish is basically eating a lot of the coral that remained, which could be, you know, some of the insurance policy for the reef.
Dr. Engelhardt again.
So the trouble is, the survivors of a mass coral bleaching event, those few corals that are showing signs of resilience and adaptation, they subsequently get targeted by the starfish, so that they combine here to actually really give the reef a hard time.
How long have we got to get these two problems under control before it's too late for the Great Barrier Reef?
That's anyone's guess, really. It is the most serious state and condition that the reef has ever been in. We know there's record low coral cover on the reef now.
He says while hundreds of millions in federal funding have been poured in to target the starfish and improve water quality, it's nowhere near enough.
The estimates are closer to like $1 billion over a few years to really address this issue. So I'm afraid it's not quite enough to turn it around. Well, the bottom line is we haven't really addressed the drivers, the underlying drivers of these outbreaks. It's mostly the runoff, the nutrient-rich runoff from agricultural use. Fertilizer runoff is the key. And of course, water quality hasn't really improved since. So whilst we know the cause, we haven't really addressed this underlying driver.
The World Wildlife Fund's Sean Hubin again.
So it's, you know, doubly heartbreaking that, you know, those reefs and those corals that survive the bleaching are now being hit by crown of thorns starfish. Global warming has to be addressed so we can, you know, address the coral bleaching effect. But pollution is something that's, you know, in our control, which our governments can act on now. And I suppose we have to act on both, but we can really make big inroads on cutting pollution so we at least are taking one of the major pressures off the reef.
How urgent is that action?
Oh, I think it's now or never. We really have to do this. There's no time for excuses.
Sean Hoobin, it's from WWF Australia, speaking with reporter George Roberts there.
Pacific Beat.
You are listening to Pacific Beat. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company this morning. To New Caledonia, where the French overseas minister has been forced to clarify comments that she made earlier this week that sparked outrage amongst French loyalists in New Caledonia. The minister, Annick Girardin, was giving a television interview when she said that in future, the French government could offer New Caledonia association with France, presumably after becoming independent. Let's take a listen to what she said.
I think the government will propose a way of working, of meeting, but also perhaps a vision where one day New Caledonia could be associated with France.
French Overseas Minister there, Annick Girardin. Well, it seems like a fairly innocuous word, association, but it is one that's caused uproar from the pro-France groups in New Caledonia, with some of them calling her comments unacceptable and others shocking. It all comes just 2 months after the territory voted to remain with France in the first of three referenda that are going to be held in the coming years. With the margin, though, the result of the outcome was slimmer than many had expected. Denise Fisher is a visiting fellow at the Australian National University Centre for European Studies. She's also a former Australian Consul General to New Caledonia. She's spoken with our reporter Lauren Beldy, saying that with an important provincial elections coming up, the strong reaction we've seen to the minister's comments are showing just how precarious the issue is going to continue to be.
She used this word associated. And this is anathema to the loyalists in New Caledonia, because in the height of the Civil War, the French proposed an associated status for New Caledonia, and they rejected this bitterly and outright. And then from then on, the war actually degenerated. So what this whole thing shows is what a sensitive period we are at the moment. That the peace that we've had for the last 30 years from these peace agreements is coming to an end. And so all sides are quite sensitive about what goes on. The minister immediately, the All Loyalist groups, wrote to the French Prime Minister objecting to what she had said. And she, a day later, clarified, saying that, of course, the future for New Caledonia will be defined with all New Caledonians who have expressed themselves clearly and incontestably the 4th of November 2018 when they voted to stay with France. So she's kind of corrected herself.
That in itself seems problematic because there are still two referenda to go in the coming years.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. This final phase will be the provincial elections in May, and then two more referendums, probably 2020 and 2022, which will, of course, be a focus of all political positioning and activity. But this is why the French state has asserted the need for dialogue and for discussion, so that really I think most observers and analysts and even the political leaders themselves would accept that the main game is actually the discussion process in the next few years, punctuated by these referendums, to work out what will New Caledonia look like after the Noumea Accord stops operation.
We've talked about the loyalist reaction to this. Did the pro-independence movement welcome this discussion or this mention of association?
There has been no response from the independence groups. As far as they're concerned, the final process of the Noumea Accord must be played out in full. It was they who negotiated a three-prong referendum process. That means that there should be two further votes. It is they who have wanted to get around the negotiating table. It is they who've worked out various plans for independence, and they will want these things discussed. But for the moment, they know they have not bought into this. They know it's a very sensitive issue.
So do you think it's more about the word or the meaning here? If you asked somebody who voted to stay with France, would they be able to explain to you what association even means?
What it means and why it's one of the reasons it's anathema to them is that in order to have an associated state, it would have to first become independent. New Caledonia would have to first become independent and then define the associations with France. And for them, any thought of becoming independent, even for a moment or a second or a juridical minute before they then looked at its association, is anathema. And the reason they're positioning themselves so clearly now is that they know there's a negotiation process ahead, and it's if you like, it's their ambit claim at the outset. No, we are staying with France. Nothing less than staying with France, full stop, at this stage in the negotiation process.
It's Denise Fisher. She's a former Australian Consul General to New Caledonia. She's now with the Australian National University. She was speaking there with our reporter, Lauren Beldy. Well, the death of a mother from complications before or during childbirth is an all too common occurrence in Papua New Guinea, and it was an issue that again made headlines this week in PNG when news that a young woman, Roselle Simai, died after giving birth to twins in a remote part of Morobe province. The 21-year-old died in the middle of the night after losing too much blood. It's understood the nearest health facility was a two-day walk away. There is some good news, though, on this issue. Medical charities are working with pregnant women like Roselle to encourage them to make the journey from their villages before there is a problem. We're going to hear more about that in a moment. But first, in the case of Roselle, the help that her family had tried to get came from Manolos Aviation. It's a helicopter charter company which helps medevac hundreds of pregnant women from remote parts of PNG each year. Jürgen Ruh is the CEO of Manolos Aviation, and I spoke with him about the case of Roselle and her twins.
Sometimes after the last child was born, they realized that the bleeding didn't stop. So we are currently planning on upgrading our capabilities to be able to fly under night vision goggles, but even that would not have helped because in a remote area which is confined, we would not go in there under goggles for the first time on the first flight. They were not able to call for help anytime soon until the next morning. They did climb the mountain, which is about a 2 or 3 hour climb, and from there they were able to call for help. So by the time they climbed the mountain and called for help, the mother actually already was deceased in the early hours of the morning. And by the time we got in there, 11:30, all we were able to pick up were the two little girls. And we took them with the guardian to the hospital. So this was certainly a tragic case. And it just wasn't possible to get somebody in there early enough. Even if the communications were better, it would have still been touch and go to get her early in the morning into hospital and her to survive as well. So she lost enough blood to die within 10 hours, basically.
But it would have been perhaps preventable if she'd been able to be assisted earlier on, or if she perhaps hadn't given birth there in that remote location?
Yeah, she had chosen to give birth at the remote location, and it's probably part of a bit of education as well. The mother really should attend clinics regularly, and if they have a birth of multiple children, they should not try and have that birth in a village. Yeah, it would have been preventable for her to go into a more accessible area, that's for sure. But many times, the women don't know when they give birth, or they just prefer to give birth in the village amongst their relatives. So.
Now, these sorts of stories are, of course, extremely common for you at Manolos Aviation. I understand that a large number of the medevacs that you do are, in fact, helping women giving birth. You mentioned there that you want to introduce or planning to introduce night goggles to ensure that you and your team can actually fly at night to save women giving birth at night time. Just how much of a difference would that make to trying to save the lives of women and their children, their babies, given PNG has such extremely high rates of maternal mortality?
What we're hoping to change is now the introducing of the night flying capability, which we've got our first goggles in now, we got our instructors in now. So we are now modifying the aircraft and training our pilots for or night flying. So we get this up and running now. The goal for Mandalore Aviation will be to have better equipped aircraft as well, with better equipment. But coming to this particular case, we could have not done anything better to get into the area during the night or in the early hours. It was a very difficult case if a mother gives birth just before dark and then loses a lot of blood. So that's nothing really that I can see that we could have done better.
It's Jürgen Ruhe, the CEO of Mandalore Aviation in PNG. Well, there is some good news and work being done, though. As Yara Murray-Atfield reports, medical charities that are working with pregnant women in remote parts of the country are proving so successful that some doctors suggest that there are, in fact, lessons that Australia could be learning about how to tackle the problem.
Only days before Dr. Barry Kirby spoke to Pacific Beach, he and his colleagues were treating a sick baby and its mother on the small town of Garawahi on PNG's north coast.
And the mother's there from the village and didn't have very much, had nothing. We started to give the baby some fluids and some antibiotic. And then we gave her the mother and baby gift. And the mother just couldn't thank Keela and the staff enough.
Dr. Kirby gets emotional when talking about his work because he's addressing a very real problem. Statistically, Papua New Guinea has one of the world's highest maternal mortality rates. He's the founder of the Hands of Rescue, a charity that works in Milne Bay province, trying to reduce the number of deaths of mothers and their babies. Olive Ua is the Health Program Manager for Child Fund Australia's Papua New Guinea office.
In my view, from seeing and having come from a rural remote setting, many mothers prefer to stay home because of the challenges they face, long distance from their homes to the nearest health facility and the transport availabilities, the transport costs, as well as when they reach the urban area, they have to find relatives to stay with until the time for them to deliver.
She was born in a remote part of Papua New Guinea's central province.
My mother was lucky enough to have me delivered, survived. So during those times, there were no health facilities available where I come from.
Dr. Kirby's charity Hands of Rescue is attempting to change that by encouraging women to make the journey from their villages to health centres before there's a problem. That includes a birthing gift for the mother and newborn child and working to train local health professionals.
It's a matter of empowering, that word is used too often, but it's a matter of empowering the people who are there. They're just as capable as anyone else on the planet, and all they need is support.
And he says it's been working in the areas he's been, reaching targets set by the United Nations.
Silver lining was that we actually did better than the United Nations Millennium Goals, and I think we might have been one of the few places in the world that actually achieved that. You know, we celebrated, but very briefly, because this is such an ongoing problem.
Dr. Colin Case is a fellow of the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine. He spends most of his time in remote Queensland and spends a few weeks a year working with Dr. Kirby in PNG. And now Dr. Case says lessons from the program could be applied to areas of Australia, especially in Indigenous communities, where the maternal mortality rate for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women is much higher than the population's average.
The other side of it is our program wasn't something that was already in existence. The Safe Motherhood program evolved by Barry spent 3 months going up into the mountains on the islands, talking to people, finding out exactly what the problems were and what the life was like for each mother that had died in a 12-month period. So by the time he'd done that, you know, we had a good idea of what the real problem was. It wasn't the fact that they were bleeding at all. It was the fact that there's a culture of having babies in a village, and that allows you then to go and work out a solution. And I think some of that is a bit lacking in the way we look after remote areas here. People want to solve the problem from a big city. They don't go out and they don't spend the time listening and talking and finding out what the real issues behind the problems are.
And Dr. Kane says Australian health professionals could benefit from seeing the stories of hope from PNG. Like a woman, he and his wife got to a hospital before it was too late when he was in Milne Bay some years back.
And she was a great happy ending story because she was going to die. She knew she was going to die and she couldn't even lift the baby up to her breast. Sue was there lifting the baby up to feed her. And she was there through an interpreter saying, please, can you lift me up, sit me up so that I can get a photo taken so that my baby will know what I looked like because I know I'm going to die. And, you know, when you sort of go through that and then you get a happy ending out of it, it makes you feel really good.
The Dr. Colin Case. He's a fellow of the Australian College of Rural and Remote Medicine, ending that report from Yara Murray Atfield. And that is all for Pacific Beach this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks very much for your company. You have a great day.